Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. She was the model for Judi Dench's M in James Bond, the first woman to run Britain's MI5, and the first top spy to write a kiss-and-tell book all about it. Now Stella Remington, Dame Stella, since 1996, writes spy fiction that runs very close to fact. In her new thriller, Russian oligarchs and Kremlin spies play for high stakes in London. That plot, says Remington, is as real as it gets today. This hour, On Point, Dame Stella Remington and spying in the 21st century. Joining me now from Washington is Stella Remington, author of the new spy novel, Illegal Action. Stella Remington, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
Trying to picture you, is it true that Judi Dench modeled her character M on you, madam?
Yes, I think that is true. I don't actually look like Judi Dench does now, but when she modeled M on me for the first time, I did look exactly like she looked in the first film.
Did you have a little shock of recognition if and when you attended those James Bond movies?
I did, actually. The first of my family to see them were my two daughters, and they came back saying, "Mum, she looks exactly like you." So I thought I better go along and have a look at this too. And I did. And yes, I did get a shock of recognition. She did look like me.
So here you are at the top of MI5, and we should say that's the Domestic Intelligence Service in the UK. You've got an MI6 that works around the world. What is it about you, Stella Remington, that took you right up through that, what I have to assume had been a boys' club, though it's not anymore the MI5, but to the very top? Have you figured out what it is in your character, your way of being, that put you in the top chair there?
I think it's quite difficult ever to analyse oneself to that extent, but it's certainly true that when I joined, which was in the very late 1960s, it was a service run exclusively by men, and women could only be assistants, sort of second class, dealing with the paperwork. But gradually the world changed, and we women fought for our rights, as you might say, and we were allowed to work at the sharp end of the business, and gradually, I suppose, sticking with it and feeling fairly determined that I wanted to do the work and could do it just as well as the men, I eventually, as you say, ended up at the top.
Now, 1992 to 96, after the Cold War, though there must have still been a fair amount of spillover from that, in the heart of the IRA, Irish Republican Army, sort of terror activity, very heavy in that time. And there you were, pushed into MI5, first the first woman to lead it, and then, of course, it hadn't even been publicly acknowledged to exist until you were, it said. It suddenly became a rather public position.
It did. Everybody knew, actually, that MI5 existed, but nobody ever knew who was in it and particularly who was leading it. But when I got the job, I was told, really, in the same breath, you're going to get the job. And by the way, the government's decided that your name is going to be announced when you take up the appointment. So I was given this as a sort of package deal. And the reason for that was that a law had been passed by then to cover the work, and the government felt that the public had a right to know who was holding the top job. So I got this sort of package, really. And I must say, I was rather taken aback because it was clear to me that if for the first time the head of the service was announced and it turned out to be a woman, this was going to be high drama stuff, particularly with the tabloid newspapers in the UK. And that's how it turned out to be.
And with that public acknowledgement, real impact on your life, both as a kind of domestic spy master there and as a mother. You had to move. Your kids paid a price for this. This was a tough time.
It was a tough time. The reason, really, I suppose, was that no real preparation was made for this announcement. I mean, everybody knows nowadays that if you're going to make a dramatic public announcement, you've got to have your press plan in place. But somehow that hadn't happened. And so the press got this announcement with no photograph to go with it, because it was at a time when the IRA was very active on the streets of London. And for security reasons, we didn't issue a photograph. And there was nobody to go on the telly and say, this is why we've announced this. And so, as you can imagine, they set about getting their own background story. And we had the press camped outside the house, worrying. I had a daughter aged 17 at the time who was still living at home. And of course, she was very worried. What if the IRA were going to get drawn to the house by all this publicity? In the end, we had to sell that house and move and live really a covert life for the rest of my time in that top job, which, of course, made it even more difficult for my two daughters.
Have they forgiven you, your daughters, for that balancing act?
They have now, yes. For a time, though, quite seriously, I was worried I was going to lose them both, requiring them to put up with this kind of life. But we sorted it all out, and we're great friends now, and we can look back on those days and laugh.
Let's turn to the new book. It's getting a great reception, and it's a great read. Financial Times says your plot bristles with subterfuge, splicing in allusions to all kinds of things actually going on now. You've got depth and tenacity here, and of course, your heroine is Liz Carlisle, and as the story opens, not only is she dispatching with a mugger on the streets of London, and just in the first couple of pages, very effectively, with what seemed to me to be a box cutter, maybe, but she's getting transferred from counterterrorism, which was hot and where the action was these days, to counterespionage, and she is not very happy about that at first. Why not?
Well, she's not very happy about it because she feels that counter-espionage is really yesterday's story and that all the action lies in the counter-terrorist field. And, of course, it is true that the main priority for our domestic security service, who's responsible for looking after us, is terrorism. But espionage still goes on and always will. Countries will always spy on each other. And she soon finds out when she gets there that there are almost as many Russian intelligence officers on the streets of London as there were during the Cold War. The only thing is that some of their targets are slightly different, as she finds out.
Among them, Nikita Brunovsky, a Russian oligarch, among the many, many in the UK, in London. Last time I was there, it seemed like there were Russians everywhere. But this guy is a target of Vladimir Putin at that point, or at least he's concerned. There's a plot to go after his life. She's sent in to avoid an international incident, try and stop that, and everything rolls out from there. Describe the real-world imprint of Russian oligarchs and, yes, for that matter, spies in London today, Stella Remington. How big, how important, how significant?
Well, to start with the oligarchs, the oligarchs are those people, those Russians who got very rich under Yeltsin, really, when many of the state industries were privatised and some of them were able to get in there and buy up large quantities and get very rich indeed. And many of them have come to live in London. So you're quite right. The streets of London are full of Russians. Not all of them oligarchs, but there are many who are, you know, buying up the best houses and all the Rolls Royces and even the soccer teams in England. So, yeah, the place is full of them. And some of them, of course, are critical of the current regime in Moscow. So that's the sort of background, really, to my plot. And the streets of London are also full, so we gather, of Russian intelligence officers. And obviously one of their targets or one of their interests must be these people, and especially if they're critical of the regime in Moscow.
Now, why so many Russian spies in the streets of London today? And not just Russian, but why so many spies, period, with the Cold War over? Does Moscow see the Russian oligarchs, fabulously wealthy, as potential political rivals, as a threat to, you know, their regime in Moscow? Or what's the broader interest of Russian spies in London today?
I think that obviously it does see some of the oligarchs as a threat if they are very vocal in criticising the regime. But I think Russia as a country has always believed in spying. I mean, Russia's history, even before the days of communism, was that they distrusted their neighbours, they distrusted other countries. So I think they'll always have well-resourced and large intelligence services who will be interested in finding out things that are not freely available to them. So spying will go on. But the targets differ, obviously, depending on the state of the world at any given time. And London's a great place to spy, of course. Don't forget, it's a place where there are many foreigners. Many other countries are represented there. And whatever your target, you can find some sort of information out, I would imagine, in today's London.
Did you enjoy spying, enjoy leading spies in intelligence service? I mean, was it viscerally satisfying to you? Were you a natural-born spy?
I don't think I'm a natural-born spy, but I certainly enjoyed the work. I mean, don't forget that what you're dealing with in MI5 is serious threats to the country, and you get a great deal of satisfaction in trying to find out what those are and hopefully preventing them. So for a good early part of my career, one of the serious threats came from the former Soviet Union and their allies, trying to find out information that would benefit them if the Cold War had ever turned to a fighting war. And then as the world rolled on, of course, we had our own serious terrorist threat from the IRA and the loyalists on the other side of the divide in Northern Ireland. And they were setting off bombs on our streets. So there are were serious, and there still are, serious threats to the country to be tackled. And the way to tackle them, in my profession, is through getting prior intelligence about what's being planned and then preventing it. And that is hugely satisfying.
I read somewhere, I think, that something like half of MI5 staff or its new recruits, you tell me, are women today. They play a very important role in Britain's internal security.
Yes, by the time I left, actually, half the service was women. Not all spread evenly throughout the ranks, but nevertheless coming up and being very successful at that kind of work. I mean, you know, it's silly to say that women are better at it than men, because all women differ from each other and all men differ from each other too. But I think the important thing is to have diversity and variety of approach, and adding women to the mix, which happened during my career, turned out to be very important. And women do have certain intuitive skills, I think, and certain analytical skills, which are very important in the intelligence field.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today with British spy chief, now thriller writer, Stella Remington, the first female head of MI5, out with her latest spy novel, Illegal Action. She was the former head of Britain's MI5, 92 to 96, the model for James Bond's M, as played by Judi Dench. Here's a bit of Judi Dench in that role from the latest Bond big screen venture, Casino Royale.
Who the hell do they think they are? I report to the Prime Minister, and even he's smart enough not to ask me what we do. They don't care what we do, they care what we get photographed doing. And how the hell could Bond be so stupid? I give him 00 status and he celebrates by shooting up an embassy. Is the man deranged? And where the hell is he? In the old days, if an agent did something that embarrassing, he'd have the good sense to defect. Christ, I miss the Cold War.
I miss the Cold War. Judi Dench in Casino Royale. Let's take a call from Toronto, Canada, and Jean. Jean, you're on the air with Stella Remington.
Hi, what an honor to speak to you, Stella. You're absolutely right about the Russian people. They do consider themselves elitists. I'm of Ukrainian origin, and we've witnessed a lot of this even in our own family. My question is, Putin's withheld energy from Ukraine. He's extremely upset that Ukraine wants to be part of the European Union. He's, he's doing everything he can to stop that. As far as Mr. Litvinenko, everyone, even in the U.S., reporters, everyone around the world seems to know that Putin was behind his murder, and I'm just wondering if you ever think there's ever a chance he'll ever be charged. I doubt it myself, but I was just wondering what you think on that whole situation.
Stella Remington, take us back to that. Of course, Alexander Litvinenko, former KGB agent, critic of the Kremlin, killed in London with polonium-210 in his tea, going on a couple years back now. Was that the inspiration for this thriller? Not entirely different in its plot line.
Not entirely different in its plot line, but I had thought of my plot before Alexander Litvinenko was killed. So while I was writing it, actually, this horrible event took place. So I began to think that fact was actually rather stranger than fiction. But hello, Jean, and thanks for your question. And the question was, I think, whether I think that anybody will ever be brought to justice for the killing of Litvinenko. And I'm afraid the answer to that is no. I mean, our investigators in the UK seem pretty certain that they know who did it. And they have apparently traced the sort of mark of the radioactive poison with which he was killed coming out of Moscow and going around in various European places. But I think the chances of the person whom the British investigators have named being extradited from Moscow is, I would say, nil, though one can never be absolutely certain about these things, and politics sometimes influences these things. But I would say that it's extremely unlikely.
How do you understand the wrestling match, some of it open, some of it under the covers, going on between Russia and, let's say, the West now, or Russia and the UK? I mean, we can understand maybe the Kremlin's concern about mega-billionaire oligarchs, Russian oligarchs in London. But there's also some echo of East-West conflict wrestling match here. What are the dynamics of it? What's it over?
Well, I think it's over Russia establishing itself after the Cold War. I mean, I think looking at this, we've got to remember that to the Russians, it must seem that they lost the Cold War. I can remember going to pay a visit to the KGB in their headquarters in Moscow in December 1991, just as the Cold War was coming to an end. And we were establishing contact with those people who'd been our enemies all that time. And to us, this was a moment of, you know, great sort of openness and possibility. To them, it was quite clear that it was a moment of failure. And I think that's the way, perhaps, that one should look at the way Russia is behaving at the moment. It's re-establishing itself as one of the great powers of the world. It's trying to get a hold and a grip of some of the things that the current regime might see went wrong during the time of Yeltsin. So I think one should interpret what looks to us as aggression in that light.
But how serious is that threat without a kind of messianic ideology behind it? I mean, you've said, I've seen the, MI5, I don't know, MI6 saying that Russia now ranks number 3 as a threat to the UK, right behind Al-Qaeda and Iranian nuclear armament. That's pretty high on the list, but why? What's the, what's the sharp edge of that stick of threat?
Well, I think that was probably an intelligence assessment about how much of the effort, the intelligence effort, my former service is having to devote to Russian intelligence officers in London when they would like to devote far more of their resources to dealing with Al-Qaeda-related terrorism. But I think that Russia is a country that has always resorted to espionage. It's trying to re-establish itself. It's trying to get a grip of its various energy resources, its industries, etc. And it is an aggressive country. You know, they have a macho style, which sometimes in the West we find it quite difficult to understand. But underneath all that, don't forget that there is business going on all the time between Western and European countries and Russia, and all that goes on quietly underneath the sort of posturing and maybe the political activity that is we see on the surface.
We're getting it straight from the source today, from Stella Remington, former head of the MI5. Her new thriller is Illegal Action, and there's plenty of thriller in there. We're joined right now as well from Bedfordshire, England, by Dr. Andrew Cook. He's an expert on the history of espionage, author of MI5's First Spy Master. Andrew Cook, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a great pleasure.
Give us a sense of what it meant when Stella Remington, a woman, emerged as the head of MI5.
I think obviously it was a landmark moment, because obviously if you trace the history of both the services in England, MI5 and MI6, both of them were obviously steeped in the sort of male domination tradition, and equally steeped in other traditions as well. And I think it's probably fair to say that both were a little bit late catching up with the real world in that sense. And I think, as I say, it was a great landmark moment when Stella Remington became Director General of MI5. And a lot of people saw that quite rightly as a very positive comment on what was going on within the service and within government.
You study these things and have over many years. What was her distinctive mark? Did she have a distinctive mark as a female director of MI5?
I think one of the strengths that Stella Remington had was the background she had within the organisation. She had been involved in the key departments and the key directorates, and I think that was a very big plus in terms of her emerging at the top of the organisation.
And when you look across the Atlantic at the U.S., does it surprise you that this country has not had a woman in a comparable position in the CIA or FBI? Is there a different culture? They put Maggie Thatcher up there and Stella Remington up there in the U.K.?
I think there's most definitely a different culture. And it's one of those ironies that, you know, if you look at the States, if you look at your political system, if you look at, CIA, FBI, yes, there's a different culture. And you can look at Britain, which in many ways, certainly in the 70s and 80s, was well behind yourselves in the culture sense, where you get a female prime minister and you get a female head of MI5. But in many cases, that's sadly untypical of the whole picture. If you look at the states as a whole, I think female advancement in commerce, industry, government, politics, espionage is probably somewhat ahead of us, but you know, you get untypical examples.
Andrew Cook, author of MI5's First Spymaster, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Stella Remington, you're a watershed, he says, or you were. Where do you see? You're in Washington today. When you look at, you know, at us Yanks and the way we do things, just on the gender front to begin with, do you get a feeling that it's ahead, behind, somewhere else here? I mean, after all, you've had Margaret Thatcher there and yourself at the top of MI5. We haven't had a female president or a female head of CIA or FBI.
No, but I think your time will come. It's just a question of waiting, really. And you've got a female Secretary of State, don't forget.
Mm.
But I think going back to the point you were discussing with Andrew there, one of the things to remember is that the British intelligence services don't have police powers or military powers, and the culture, therefore, is rather different from your FBI and your CIA. MI5, in particular, is an intelligence gathering and analytical service, and when it comes to arrests being made, it works very closely with the police to achieve that. So I think the culture of the organisations are different, and maybe that means that women do better in them than they do in a more either military or police-based service.
MI5 has a reputation, I think, for being more intrusive than American police and intelligence services have been, at least domestically. I don't know if you've kept up over the debate in this country about domestic surveillance, but I wonder how you see it. I have the sense that the UK is much more active in what we might call infringing on its citizens' privacy than American police and security agencies, but maybe I'm wrong. What's your assessment?
Well, I think there's a big debate going on in the UK at the moment between the so-called civil libertarians and the government, really, particularly over the length of time that the police should be allowed to hold suspects in terrorist cases.
The habeas corpus question that we're also wrestling with.
Yeah, without bringing charges against them.
Mm.
And, of course, there is another big debate about the extent to which the government is intruding into our civil liberties with all these cameras all over the place, etc. And I think it is true that many people in the UK are concerned about this. But I think that one should remember that one of the great, the reasons why British intelligence has been very effective is that the right powers have been given to our intelligence services. And if you look back to 9/11, prior to 9/11, one of the issues in this country appears to have been that the CIA and the FBI couldn't exchange information, and information that was available didn't get to the right place and wasn't properly acted on. I think that's something that couldn't happen in the United Kingdom. So there are pluses and minuses here, and I think one's got to just try and get the right level in this balance between our civil liberties and the effectiveness of our intelligence services.
We have a lot of callers putting their hands up for a chat with you. Let's go to truck driver Steve on Interstate 85 West in North Carolina. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello, ma'am. It's an honor to speak with you. I have two questions. The first being, is that where do you see Islamic extremism going in Europe and in the UK in particular in the future? And my second question, I was a contractor over in Iraq, and so this is why I'm asking, is that where do you see the privatization of the military going forward? Do you see it expanded or do you see it staying the same?
Hello, Steve. I think on your first question, where is Islamic extremism going in the UK? I think we're in a very difficult period in the UK at the moment. I mean, we're being told by those who are currently in touch that there are a large number of plots being investigated by our police and our intelligence services to carry out mass casualty attacks in Britain. And it seems that we have a small number of alienated young people who are prepared to carry out these attacks on unconnected citizens, people on a bus or people on a train. I think that's a very alarming situation. And as far as I can gather, though I have no access any longer to secret information, it doesn't appear to be getting better, but rather getting worse. And I think the reasons for that are very complex. So, gloomy, I'm afraid, is my assessment in answer to your first question.
Oh, still on the first question, may I just follow on with that, Stella Remington? What about the war on terror that President Bush has framed and launched from the United States? Does that seem to you to be the way to address that issue in the UK, in Europe, globally?
I never thought that the phrase war on terror or war on terrorism was a very good one, actually, because it gives the impression that terrorism is something that can be tackled militarily, whereas, in fact, it can't, in my opinion, not if you're talking about terrorism being carried out within the different countries. And I think that the declaration of a war on terrorism, and particularly the war in Iraq, has unfortunately acted as something of a recruiter for some of these young people that I was describing, who feel, for their own reasons, that their culture, their religion is being attacked, and therefore, you know, they have gone off and fought and got themselves trained and are now prepared to attack the country that they see is participating in this. So I'm afraid, you know, in my opinion, the concept of a war on terrorism was a misguided one.
And if not that, then what? What approach?
Well, I think the approach should be the approach that we've taken against terrorism for the last 30 years. I mean, in the United Kingdom, we've been fighting terrorism since the late 1960s from the IRA, our own domestic terrorists, and from what we then called international terrorism even then. And the approach is the quiet gathering of intelligence, the assessing and the analysing, the trying to bring situations to a point where people can be arrested. In other words, deal with it quietly and undramatically, and that's how you get results.
And Steve was a private contractor in Iraq. It sounds as though in support of the U.S. military effort there. Is that an issue in the U.K.? What do you make of the rather large American dependence now on privately paid or private contractors supporting the military efforts?
I'm not an expert on Iraq, so I don't really think that I'm the right person to ask about this. But I think it's probably, you know, an inevitable progression, really, as, you know, the task begins to change from a military task to a task of rebuilding infrastructure, etc. It's probably inevitable that this will happen. But as I say, the actual war in Iraq is not one of my areas of expertise.
But do you have the same thing in the UK where there are private security guards toting machine guns to defend your diplomats, British government representatives on foreign soil? Do you do that?
Not to the extent that you do.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about the relationship between the UK and US around intelligence these days? Has the terrorism threat that's now hit the US as well made that closer, or are we off on two different paths in our response?
Well, I'm not in touch now, but I think it very unlikely that we're off on two different paths. The relationship, the intelligence relationship between the UK and the USA has always been very close, right dating back to World War II. And certainly during my working life, the United States was one of our closest intelligence allies, and I have absolutely no doubt that it still is. But of course, intelligence cooperation worldwide now is much closer than it was, well, certainly than it was during the Cold War, when we were all rather suspicious of each other. But, you know, certainly the relationship between the UK and the USA has always been close.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with ex-British spy chief, now thriller writer, Stella Remington, first female head of MI5, out with her latest spy novel, Illegal Action. Lots of callers. David in Augusta, Georgia. You're on the air with Stella Remington.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a huge fan of John le Carré's earlier Cold War novels, and I've always felt that they were very accurate depiction of the service during that time, and I wanted to get your guest comments on that, and I'll take those offline.
Stella.
Yeah, hello, David. I do entirely agree with you, actually. I think John le Carré's account of Cold War espionage, the intelligence world is the best, actually, is really, really good, and it does remind me to an extent of the service that I joined in the very late 1960s when there was this, you know, sense of paranoia almost. There was this fear that each side's intelligence service had been infiltrated by the other, and nobody was quite who they seemed to be. and it was the classic Wilderness of Mirrors. So I do agree with you.
And who else did you read, have you read, when it comes to spy thrillers? Who are your models, if that's the right word, or inspiration?
I don't personally think I have any direct models. And, you know, I go back to John le Carré as being the expert in this area. But I suppose, you know, the number of spy writers who've actually worked in the intelligence field in one way or another is quite considerable. And you've only got to sort of go back to people like Graham Greene, or even further back to Somerset Maugham, for example. And I think, you know, I would say this, wouldn't I, that you get the best and the most accurate account of what it's like from people who've actually experienced it.
Judi Dench has put a kind of portrayal of you into her role as M in James Bond. What about the Bond books, the Bond movies?
The Bond movies, of course, are totally unrealistic. You know, they're great fun and everybody loves them, but all the gizmos and the sort of mad rushing about, and Bond isn't really an intelligence officer at all. He's just a licensed killer, in my opinion. But, you know, it makes for a good watch, but please don't anybody think that it's anything like the intelligence world.
So what's off about it? What's totally unrealistic about James Bond?
What's totally unrealistic is one man going off on his own totally to, you know, solve a problem. He goes to see M. He's shown, you know, a photograph or a very small sort of file and given his air tickets and his gizmo from Q and told, you know, go off and save the world. That is not how it works. Intelligence organisations and bureaucracies, basically, they work in teams. You know, they have a lot of backup. There's a lot of thought and analysis goes into it. And James Bond goes completely off on his own, much to M's annoyance, of course, from time to time.
Talk a little bit about your special agent, Liz Carlyle. Not James, but Liz, in a different time. How much of Liz Carlyle is based on Stella Remington, yourself? And what's her character as an agent?
Liz Carlyle is bound to be a bit based on me. I mean, she's a 30-ish year old female MI5 officer who finds it still necessary, really, to assert herself against some of the old-fashioned men, particularly Geoffrey Fane of MI6. I have a bit of fun, I must say, with characterising the MI6 officers and the MI5 officers rather differently. She's a tough cookie. She's determined, and she combines a sort of intelligent, analytical brain with a female intuition, which eventually gets her to the solution of the various problems that she has to deal with.
And the environment that she's up against compared to, let's say, a Jean Le Carré Cold War environment, is the same paranoia there? Is there a different feeling, a different sort of mood in the air of this work these days in
yes,
her fictional world?
There is a completely different mood. The enemy is very clear. The target is very clear. And the main target, as I've said, is terrorists. And these are people against whom you have to work quickly. In the old days, when we were dealing mainly with the espionage threat, the way one dealt with that was by slow, careful analysis. Often over the years, you studied the hostile intelligence service, you understood the way they would work, you knew about their people. Nowadays, you don't have that time. You have to move fast. You have to take decisions, often on the basis of incomplete information, and it's risky, and sometimes you get it wrong, inevitably. But you can't hang about, because if you hang about, the bomb may go off and many, many people may be killed. So it's a different ethos, a different world.
You were at the top of that organization. You had to make a lot of decisions quickly, not least about people, about who to give what assignments, who would be a good agent or a good handler of agents. What did you look for in the people that you wanted most responsible under you?
Not James Bond's, I would say. What you're looking for, I think, are people who combine analytical skills, the ability to receive a whole mass of information and make some kind of sense out of it. You're looking for people with common sense, with their feet firmly on the ground, and you're looking for people who can take responsibility as self-starters and don't, whom you can rely on when they're out in a situation where you can't ring up the boss and say, this unexpected thing has happened, what shall I do? So they've got to be people whose good judgment and common sense you can rely on, and who also have the ability to talk to people, from anybody, from a duke to a dustbin man, and impress them and persuade them to do things that sometimes no sane person would do. So it's quite an unusual mix of characteristics in one person that you're actually looking for. And that is what I've tried to portray in Liz.
How did you handle male subordinates or agents who seemed, however subtly, to bridle at the fact that you were female? Did you just sort of deal with it and send them on out if they seemed well qualified, or did you, put them on a sidetrack and bury their careers?
No, I mean, it's a question of judging the person in the round, isn't it, really?
Mm-hmm.
And I think I tended to ignore any kind of barbed comment of that kind and just pretend I hadn't heard, or just get on with it, really. But it is a question of judging people in the round and making the best of the qualities that they've got. But I didn't suffer from too much of that, certainly not in the later part of my career.
Well, you were the boss. Let's go to Margaret in Amherst, Massachusetts. Margaret, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I have three quick questions.
Yeah.
What is it like not to have access to that level of high security information? Was it hard to adjust to your new life? And are you ever concerned about your own safety? I'll take my response off the line.
Thanks, Margaret. Stella Remington?
I have got used to not being at the heart of things. I must say, though, that at the very beginning, when I first left, it was quite difficult suddenly not to know what's going on and not to, be a part of the centre. So it was quite hard to adjust, but I've certainly adjusted to it now. And, you know, I still feel quite well looked after. I'm still obviously in touch with my former colleagues, and I know what I need to know about my own security. It's not a job that it's easy to leave, and that's why you have to kind of reinvent yourself in your retirement, as I have done.
Do you, Margaret asks, ever fear for your safety now? Do you have to take special precautions? Do you still live anonymously, or is that behind you?
I tend not to talk about the security arrangements that I make, because obviously the more you talk about them, the less effective they become. So that's a question that I'd prefer not to answer.
That seems reasonable. Let's take a call from Savannah, Georgia. Lee, you're on the air with Stella Remington.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I think MI5 is very much a mystery to most Americans. As you indicated, we don't really have a comparable agency. However, there's a very enjoyable BBC television program called MI5 in America. I think it's called Spooks when it's broadcast in the UK. And if your guest is familiar with it, I was wondering, is that at all an accurate depiction of what your agency does, or is it as fanciful as James Bond?
Haven't seen it. Stella, do you know it?
Yes, I know it, Lee. Yes, I've seen it. I can't say that I watch it in every day, but I have seen it. And I'm afraid it isn't a very accurate portrayal of what MI5's about, as you would expect, really, because these things have to be made much more excitable for television. But I think the particular thing that's not accurate is the level of violence that there is in that programme. And it seems to me it's got more and more violent as it's gone on. MI5 officers are intelligence assessors, they're intelligence gatherers, and they act on intelligence, but they don't unnecessarily put themselves into danger. And nor is the world saved, again, by about three people every week going out and tackling the problem. As I said, I think in reply to a question about James Bond, there is bureaucracies behind these things. There are people in teams. There are rules and regulations. And I'm afraid none of that comes over very clearly in MI5. But then I suppose, you're talking about entertainment here, not fact.
Lee, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Foxborough, Massachusetts. And Dennis. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question for Stella has to do with Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. And I'm making an assumption here that MI5 valued objectivity and even-handedness in dealing with the IRA groups on the one hand and with the unionist groups on the other hand. So based on that assumption, first, is that assumption correct? Second, how did you go about establishing that objectivity, if you did? And thirdly, if you did do that, how successful do you believe you were?
Dennis, stick with us. I'd love to hear what you make of Stella's response. Dame Stella?
Yes, certainly my former service dealt with the terrorist threat from both sides of the divide in Northern Ireland, both from the IRA and from the so-called loyalist groups. And it was the threat to the country that we were dealing with, the terrorist threat, not the politics of the matter. And yes, we treated them both as targets to be infiltrated and to be understood and to be prevented insofar as they were both conducting terrorist operations. How successful were we? I think the answer is towards the end, we were pretty successful. And I think one of the bases for a peace process was that the intelligence had proved so successful that the effectiveness of the terrorists was waning, and therefore it seemed to them time to come to the table and to discuss a peace process.
But Dennis asks if you saw yourself as even-handed in your handling of the two groups. In a broader sense, was that the posture that you understood MI5 having?
Our job was to find out what terrorism was being planned, nothing to do with the politics. Mm-hmm. And insofar as that went, yes, we saw them both as equally important targets for our work, insofar as they were conducting terrorism. So, you know, you have to put our work in the context of the role of the security service, which is to protect the country against serious threats of harm, not to deal with the politics of the situation. That's for governments to do.
Dennis, what do you make of that response from the former head of the MI5 when things were pretty hot on the Ireland front?
Well, you know, to me, it seems like a very difficult position to be in, because on the one hand, I listened to Stella saying earlier that they would deal with law enforcement, although they weren't specifically law enforcement, but intelligence gathering mm-hmm. as a group. And since there was a Northern Irish police force, RUC or whatever, to deal with in that sort of interaction on the one hand, but no such group to deal with as far as the IRA groups were concerned. That's where my question came. I just wondered, I guess maybe the question should have been, was it easy to maintain objectivity in dealing with the RUC, because did they have objectivity in dealing with the two groups, the unionist groups, terrorists, if you will, and the IRA?
Stella Remington?
Yeah, that's is an entirely different question, and you're quite right that it was the RUC and the RUC special branch that was responsible for the terrorist threat actually within Northern Ireland. My service was dealing with the threat as it translated into Great Britain or in foreign countries, for example, in Germany, when they were trying to kill British soldiers. And you are quite right in your inference that in those earlier days, the RUC was primarily made up of people from the Protestant community. That is, you know, these things are factually correct. And one of the main efforts since the peace process came in has been to broaden the basis for recruitment to the police force of Northern Ireland. That's probably, you know, all I can comment on. I can't really comment on the details of how the RUC went about their work.
Dennis, thanks very much for your call. And let's get one more from Hartford, Connecticut. Frank, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom and Dame Stella. I wondered if Dame Stella had read Legacy of the Ashes by Tim Weiner. I was horrified reading it myself, and what she thought of our CIA.
This is a kind of a scathing expose of CIA problems that Tim wrote, yes.
And would she ever write a book of such kind about MI5?
I haven't read that book, Frank, I'm afraid. Just tell me a bit about what it says.
It's a history of the CIA exposing all of the many foibles and mistakes that they made over many years, and a lot of the problems we're dealing with today being a direct result of their misadventures.
Right. Well, no, I wouldn't write that kind of a book.
Though you did write a memoir, Open Secret. There was quite a hubbub about it when it first came out in the UK, the idea of an MI5 head writing kiss and tell on your work.
It wasn't a kiss and tell, actually. I wrote my life story. I wrote a memoir, and it did cause a furore. I submitted it for clearance to my former colleagues and took out anything that, you know, was seen to be damaging in any way. I think one of the reasons why it caused a furore was not for what it said, but for the fact that somebody in my position was writing their life story. Those people who were so anguished that I might be going to reveal the nation's secrets were equally anguished when it was published, and they discovered that I wasn't. But that was a completely different kind of book, because that was about me, not about, you know, the history of my former service. There is a history of my former service being written to coincide with their 100th anniversary, which should come out in 2009. Now, it's being written by a professor. He's had full access to the documents of the service. So to what extent that's going to reveal, you know, past history, I don't know. But I'm not sure that I personally would not say that MI5 had that many skeletons in its cupboard to be revealed. And if the CIA has, then that's a different cup of tea.
Last question on gender. You're sort of you've got this kind of a jerk, Jeffrey Fain, MI6, the foreign part. And he says at one point, these young women in MI5 nowadays are very defensive. Thank goodness in our neck of the woods, we're still masculine. It makes life so much easier. You've been at the heart of all this. Do we ever get past it? Or does that kind of war of gender just go on forever? Or maybe are we working our way past it?
I think and hope that we are working our way past it. But it still does exist, without a doubt. And, you know, in my country, in the Church of England, there's a big debate going on about whether women can be bishops, for example. And if that's not the war of gender, I don't know what is.
Stella Remington, former Director General of Britain's MI5, now thriller writer, author of the new thriller, Illegal Action. And it is a gripping story. It's been great speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it too.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.